Casey Gardinia Libraries would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which this podcast was recorded. We wish to pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging, and to any Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening.
Welcome to Book Matters. We are your one-stop destination for everything about books, reading, and authors. We chat to great writers from Australia and all over the world, as well as bringing you some great reading recommendations from our staff here at the library. So make yourself a cuppa, sit back, and enjoy.
Today on the podcast, Janine speaks with Sydney author Genevieve Gannon, who is an award-winning Sydney-based journalist and the author of four novels. Her new book, The Gifted Son, explores the subject of the King Hit, when a talented student is a victim and the consequences of everyone around him. Genevieve is fast becoming the Australian version of Jodi Picoult, where she writes about moral dilemmas in her novels. Then Courtney speaks with Aussie writer Simon Rowell about his crime thriller series. His latest novel is a fast-paced crime story, vividly set in the towns along the Murray River. Wild Card is a gripping new mystery about gang warfare and small-town corruption, featuring a crime-fighting duo like no other. We hope you enjoy.
Genevieve Gannon is an author and award-winning journalist based in Sydney. Over her 15-year career, she has worked as a frontline reporter in Canberra, Melbourne and Sydney, covering crime, health, social affairs and politics. She was the lead court reporter for Australian Associated Press and has been published in most major Australian newspapers. She is presently the staff writer for the nation's biggest women's magazine, the Australian Women's Weekly, where she covers everything from cold case murders and cults to celebrities and sports stars. Her first novel was published in 2014. She followed this with two more novels, but her breakout release, The Mothers, published by Allen and Unwin in 2019, was based on real-life cases of embryo mix-ups in IVF labs and became an Australian bestseller. We chat to Genevieve today about her new novel, The Gifted Son, which has just come out. Welcome to Book Matters, Genevieve.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Congratulations on the release of your new novel, The Gifted Son. How does it feel to see it out there on the shelves?
Oh, thanks so much. It feels particularly nice to see this one out on the shelves because the amazing designer at Allen & Unwin, Nader, did such a beautiful job. That lovely rainbow colour cover just looks so amazing. And whenever I see it on the shelves, I just feel so happy that I'm so lucky to have such beautiful artwork representing the story. It always feels good to have a new book out in the world, but it feels extra good when you've got something so lovely to look at.
Oh, that's great. Now, before we get into the nitty-gritty about this new novel, I must say you must be a very busy lady with your career and your writing. Can you tell us how you transitioned from journalism to writing and how do you juggle your work days combined with a family to look after as well?
I suppose it's just to really enjoy the novel writing. So for me, it's my hobby and my escape. Where other people might read or garden or take a little bit more time cooking. Cooking's always fairly basic, whereas some people really love to cook, so they spend a lot of time making beautiful cakes and stews and things. All of that time I spend working on these books, which is something that I really enjoy doing. So, yeah, full-time job during the day, but it's they're pretty good at the weekly. They let us out at a pretty reasonable hour. So plenty of time in the evening and a little bit of proofreading sometimes on the train as well. Yeah, hopefully while you're dreaming and then you go up to your great scene. So yes, sleeping is necessary.
Oh, that's good. Now, your new novel, The Gifted Son, which I'm fortunate enough to have already read and I thoroughly enjoyed it despite the subject matter, has been released. For the benefit of our listeners that haven't read it yet, can you tell us all about it?
Yeah, so it's about a family who live in Sydney, the Hogarth family, mother and father, son and daughter, and we meet them on a hot spring day, late in November, the last day of school, in fact. Jamie's their younger son and it's his last day of school, so Lillian and John Hogarth are facing that empty nest and it's late for them. Jamie was quite sick when he was little and they're sort of preparing for him to go off into the world. And on the last day, his last day, muck-up day, as we all know, can be a high adrenaline day for Year 12. He is caught up in an altercation. He's punched just once, but as we know, that's all it takes. He falls back and sustains a very serious injury and is hospitalised. And the narrative kind of jumps off from there. We follow each character, each member of the family and other members of their community responding to that punch, that hit, inciting incident, including Jamie himself.
Yeah. And you've written about a very topical subject at the moment, the king hit or the one punch, which unfortunately has become a bit of a tragic feature in the news over the last few years. Is this where you drew your inspiration for the book?
It's funny. It's actually not. Well, I mean, kind of, but weirdly, this is the first full-length novel I ever attempted to write about 10 years ago. It had quite a different, in fact, it had a completely different character in the Jamie role. But the journey that we see Jamie go on in this novel is something that I'd attempted before. But that character, that original character, was actually a girl and she sustained her injury in a fall. So I suppose in some ways when I returned to this idea wanting to see if I could make this novel work because it didn't work the first time, I suppose the fact that the one punch was in the news did make me think, oh, what could I do differently? What could the inciting incident be that's different to the passive fall? That first attempt, the young girl was on holidays with her family and she simply slipped. It was an unfortunate accident. Having the incident occur as a result of tension between boys on the last day of school is a lot more interesting. So actually, even though I started that answer by saying no, I suppose ultimately, but there were many other factors that went into it as well.
Yeah, and you did also write about what I call a family in crisis. Mm-hmm. All is not what it appears, and that's a very sad fact today because image is everything, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think, as you say, particularly today, we see members of our community, a lot of the time we see them through the lens of social media and that's just a veneer and you never really know what's going on underneath. Absolutely.
Yeah, and there were quite a lot of points of view in this novel too. And obviously we hear from Jamie himself. We hear from his mum, Lillian, who considers Jamie the golden child. His father, John, who has his own business and spares no expense for his family. And then Jamie's older sister, Kate. And one of the most interesting characters, I think, too, was Jez, which is one of his friends and fellow classmate who faces the ultimate moral dilemma about the whole incident. And they've all got their own stories to tell. Were the characters in your mind when you started writing this book, or did they appear as your writing went on?
I think when I began the second attempt, yes, they were all there, but they definitely weren't all as prominent as they are. They're all fairly... I mean, definitely there's more of Lillian and Jamie, but they all get heard. They all get a couple of chapters each, and that definitely wasn't the plan when I started. But I think it makes it a lot more interesting. It was something that evolved as I was writing, and then I really went into the shoes of the various different characters and imagined the scenario from different perspectives.
Yep. And, of course, Jamie's the key character in this book, and you did a terrific job of investigating too, or showing the privilege angle of going to a private school and bullying, which happens regardless of which school you attend. But, you know, they obviously, a lot of people think, oh, you go to a private school, everything's all nice there. But, it isn't, as I said before, all is not as it appears. Yeah. Did you know how the book was going to end when you started writing it?
Yes.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, and the first attempt as well ended in the same way. And I must say, first attempt was completely different. It was really my first go at writing like a novel-length piece for an adult audience. So I really had no idea what I was doing and it was very bad. The story that eventually gets told in this book is the story that I wanted to tell all the way back then. I just didn't have the skills at the time.
Yeah. And what made you give up on that book when you first started writing it, and what made you go back to it?
Oh, well, I didn't give up on it. I finished it and I gave it to a whole bunch of publishers and they kind of said, it's not very good. Look, they said it in the kindest possible way. And the woman who published it at Allen & Unwin, Annette, she actually read that very first version and she took me out for coffee and she gave me a copy of The Husband's Secret by Leanne Moriarty and sort of said, keep going and keep trying and keep practicing. And she's right, it's like anything, you just, the more you do it, the better you get.
And I suppose now you look back at that original book, you probably think, yep, they were right to say no at that stage.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank God they said no.
Now, you've obviously done a fair bit of research for this novel too, especially with the medical side of things. Would that be right?
Yes. I felt that was really important. It's quite daunting writing about someone acquiring a disability. And I second-guessed myself a lot. But, I think just ensuring that just research and research as much as you possibly can. If you're going to do that, you've got to do it properly. Hopefully it sort of rings true for everyone.
No, it was really good. And it actually, like anyone who reads it, it gives a really good description of what the consequences of that accident were and what happened after that. So no, I think you did a really good job. Now, I want to go back to your previous novel which was the first one that I read, and The Mothers. And it was an absolute page turner, and you just blew me away with the content of it. Without giving too much away, it involved a mix up with IVF, which resulted in babies being born to the wrong parents. And we do hear of this happening, such a sensitive subject. What prompted you to write about that?
Yeah, well, it was actually just reading those stories. I was researching the IVF industry for my job at the Women's Weekly, and I came across one of the first court cases that involved an IVF mix-up and a custody battle over a child. And I just could not believe that had happened. And the more I looked into it, I discovered that, I mean, it's not common, but it has happened. It has certainly happened more than once. And the thought of it was just, I just couldn't get my head around how any of that could happen, how you could live with it. It's so affecting for everyone involved. It's such an impossible question to untangle. And I've since seen some features with people who have been adopted, and I know it gave me a deeper appreciation for that sense of disconnection that you can feel even when the adoption is a happy outcome, where you've got a solid family unit. Just that sense of being removed from your birth family, what that can do to a person. So I suppose that made me think of it anew, but I just kept on reading cases and judges having to make decisions and all of the factors that they looked at. And yeah, I just thought that it was something that was worth exploring in fiction. And it's definitely very divisive.
Oh, and like there's a new television show on Channel 9 at the moment, Big Miracles, and where they actually show people going through down the IVF route. And you sort of, by watching that, you think, how in the heck could that ever have happened? Because everyone seems to be so focused and there's only one person who's actually dealing with that. And you sort of think, oh, my God, how could that possibly happen?
Yeah, maybe I shouldn't say this. I have to double check it. But I believe the doctor involved in that first case that I mentioned has done it. I saw a headline that he's done it again. Look, I probably shouldn't have checked.
You don't want to get sued or anything?
No, but yeah, I suppose I haven't given any.
You haven't mentioned names.
There's never been a case of it in Australia. I think the systems here are very good. I don't know. America seems to have a bit of a problem with it. Maybe that's not fair. It's not, look, it's really not that common, but I guess it's such a shocking thing that when it does happen, you really think.
Now, I believe the rights to make a TV series or a movie have been sold. That's exciting.
Yeah, that's right. Pip Carmel, who's an amazing screenwriter, she did some work on Total Control recently, and in fact, she's got a show coming out right now on Stan called Bad Behaviour. She is developing a script for it.
When do you think, I know how long's a piece of string, but have you got any idea how long it would take before it actually gets done?
Well, it's one of those things, isn't it? There are so many hurdles. Look, you can have a script and maybe hopefully we'll see it on screens, but there are a lot of factors that go into it.
Oh, yes, you've got to get the funding. I think that's the biggest one, isn't it?
Yes.
And who would you choose if you had the choice to play Priya and Grace?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Sarah Snook, and I think he has the right complexion for Grace. If anyone's read the book, they'll know that Grace is deliberately very fair, which the reason for that becomes obvious if you've read the book.
Yes, no spoilers, yep.
Yeah, no spoilers. I don't know. Or any of the characters, really. That's kind of a fun surprise. It's weird. I try not to think about it too much.
Because you don't want to get your hopes up too. Now, look, there was a bit of a gap between writing The Mothers and Gifted Son. Do you have another novel in progress at the moment?
Yeah, I do. And The Gifted Son was it kind of got derailed a bit by COVID, so I would have preferred to have been able to do that faster, but just with everything that was happening, it kind of got derailed is the right word. But yes, I'm sort of powering through a new one, so
okay.
Hopefully the gap won't be as long.
Oh, good. And will that also have some sort of a moral dilemma in it?
Yes. Yeah. I don't know how much I can say.
No, not yet.
Fans of The Mothers, we do see a character from that book.
And
it's quite a surprising character. It's not a character you would think. So there are definitely some intersecting themes, but it's not a sequel in any way.
Okay, so you could read it as a standalone without having read The Mother. Now, after reading both of your books, I would say you are vastly becoming the Australian Jodie Picoult, who also writes in a similar style. In fact, I think you're probably better than her because with her, I sort of think I've read a lot of her books and they're either hit and miss with me. Some of them are just excellent and some of them I think, not quite so good.
Oh, that's such a compliment. Thank you so much. Can you please put that in writing and send it to my publisher?
I'll send it to your agent and just let them know. I would do that, no problems at all. Now, in your spare time, I'm being facetious, what style of books do you like reading and what are you reading at the moment?
At the moment, I'm reading the Poisonwood Bible, which is, I know it came out a very long time ago, but it had been on my bookshelf for years and my boss recently read it and was raving about it. So I thought, finally, I'm going to read it. And over the summer, I was reading The Marriage, I'm going to get the name wrong.
The Marriage Portrait?
Marriage Portrait, that's right, which I was really enjoying, slightly put it down in favour of the Poisonwood Bible. And I've just finished Tomorrow and Tomorrow by Gabrielle Zevin, which I adored and inhaled in a couple of days.
That's good. And if our listeners want to connect with you, what's the best way they can do that? What social media platforms are you on?
I love Instagram for connecting with readers and other writers and people who love books. So yeah, Instagram's a great way to connect with people, I think. I love that you can share photos of the books that you're reading, photos of yourself reading and all sorts of bookish things.
I think I've connected. Well, I'm a friend of yours on Instagram, so it's lovely to see where people are and what they're doing. Yeah, I totally agree with you. Now, in summary, what would you like people to take away from your books?
I think you've summed it up. Like, I really like writing stories that make people question their first impressions. Definitely with The Mothers, when I read about that first case, I had a really strong opinion on what I thought should have happened. And then when I read the reasoning why that didn't happen, I rethought that. And I really like having sort of first impressions challenged. And with The Gifted Son, that was very much inspired by my work as a court reporter, where I found that would often happen. You would have a prosecutor come in and describe the acts of an individual and you would think, this person needs to be locked up forever, how dare they, etc. And then the defense lawyer would come in and talk about that person's life and you would think, well, yes, they've done this horrible thing, but they never really had much of a chance in the first place.
That's right. And it's that thought-provoking books. Yeah, I think you do it really well.
Thank you. I enjoy, you asked before, when I fit it in and everything. It's sort of something I enjoy thinking about and writing about. I hope to continue to do it for a long time.
Oh, that's good. Now, Genevieve's books are available to borrow from the library in either paperback or audiobook form and are also available as ebooks and e-audiobooks from Libby. It's been great chatting with you today, Genevieve. It's personal. I'm so glad I finally got to talk to you after all this time. And I encourage readers who like a fast-paced, thought-provoking novel to borrow your books now. I wish you every success with The Gifted Son and look forward to your next book. Thank you once again.
Well, I hope you have me back when that one comes out, hopefully next year.
Oh, excellent. Right, that's a date. Thanks, Genevieve.
Bye-bye.
Simon Rowell is a Victorian writer who has worked on oil rigs in the outback, managed nightclubs, been a tour guide, and even run marketing campaigns. However, the dream from 18 was always to be a writer. At 48, Simon began writing on his first published novel, The Echo of Others, which would be published in 2017, and earned the prestigious spot on the long list for the Ned Kelly Award for First Crime Novel in 2018. Since then, Simon has gone on to publish The Long Game, which introduces readers to Detective Sergeant Zoe Mayer of the Victoria Police and her dog Harry. A clever and beautifully plotted crime fiction, The Long Game created a hunger from readers to hear more from Zoe and Harry, and Simon has delivered with his follow-up novel, Wildcard. Welcome to Book Matters, Simon.
Thank you, Courtney. Thanks for having me on.
So before we get into chatting about Wildcard, I wanted to ask about your journey to being a published author. As I said in the intro, you've known you've always wanted to be a writer, but it took you a long time to get to the point where you were published. Did you find that taking that time and putting that dream on hold has helped mold you as a writer? And if so, in what way?
No, absolutely. I found it really, I wanted to be a writer when I was quite young, but I hadn't really done a whole lot in my life in terms of experience like everyone else. And I thought, well, I need to really go out and have a bit of life experience. And I did that did a lot of strange, odd jobs in oil fields and nightclubs and things before I was 25, before I sort of buckled down to went to university and did a couple of the courses and then went on to a corporate career. So I then worked in Melbourne for 25 years and decided, if not now, never. So I jumped in and then wrote that first book.
Yeah, I also read The Echo of Elders, loved it. So in what way have you found that your life experience has impacted on your writing and your books?
I think it's just sort of the sum total of different interactions with people over the years. Working in the oil fields, I also worked a major building pipeline when I was 17 down in the middle of Australia. And I met all sorts of interesting, sometimes crazy characters in those sort of places. And just kept them all in the memory bank for many years, and some of them are now reappearing on page.
Yeah, and it's quite an interesting resume you have, oil rigs, marketing, but you've held on to that dream of being a writer for such a long time. What is it that you love about being a writer and an author?
I just like the idea of putting together stories. I mean, there's parts of the writing process that I absolutely love and there's parts that I loathe. But it's just the ability to put together a story that's compelling with a character that people seem to really connect with is really satisfying.
Yeah. I guess it's that feedback you get from readers when, you know, you've created something that you love and they love too.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I've got two main characters in the book. One is Zoe Mayer, who's the detective sergeant in the homicide squad. And a lot of people have commented how they love Zoe and they'd like to actually be friends with her in real life. So really connected with her. And obviously the dog's an integral part of the story as well in terms of the way he interacts, helps Zoe with her PTSD and also helps her inadvertently because he reacts to people's emotions. And she actually realises over the course of the first two books so far that she can actually use that to her advantage when interviewing people.
Yep, absolutely. And I certainly want to talk a little more about Zoe and definitely Harry. But for our listeners who may not have had a chance to pick up your books yet, can you give them a bit of a summary of what The Long Game and the new one, Wildcard, is about?
Okay, so start with the last one first. The Wildcard is a book that's set up in the Shuka Moama region up on the border between New South Wales and Victoria. And, yeah, a body is found in a burnt-out area of grassland up there. So heavily sort of tattooed victim. He's got two bullet wounds in his head and he's identified as a local bikie named Freddie Jones. So Zoe and her dog Harry are on the case along with her human partner Charlie Shaw, and they're pretty determined to track down the murderer very quickly, but she finds herself really stonewalled at every turn by the victim's family, by his associates, and even somewhat by the local police. A King of Hearts playing card is found in the victim's pants when he's in the with the pathologist. But no one has a clue what this playing card means, what it signifies. And then a second body is found and everything, and all bets are really off then, and it really ramps up.
All hell breaks loose after that, I think.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and The Long Game was a book that was set down in the Mornington Peninsula. That was about a local surfer who was found deceased with a knife in his chest in Portsea. And Zoe's actually in that first book has just come back from extended leave. She's really just come back from 3 months off after a very serious incident, which gets sort of revealed through the book. And in that book too, there's an obvious suspect for the murder, and they make an arrest, but it's all very neat, and none of Zoe's colleagues believes that the theory is actually her theory, that the whole thing is actually a bit of a stitch up, and then someone's trying to hunt Zoe down in that case. So that book is set on the Mornington Peninsula mainly, down the coast and also up near Warburton a bit, and that really started off the whole story with Zoe and Harry.
Yeah, and so with the second book, I wanted to ask you about your setting of Echuca and Moama, because I actually have family that live up that way, and I think you captured it really beautifully. But the crime fiction, especially in regional towns, is really popular at the moment. What was it that appealed to you about setting your book in that Echuca Moama location?
Echuca and Moama are obviously two separate towns across the river from one another on different sides of the border, but they're not huge. It's not a huge community. They're large, but not so large that they've become, you know, you can actually get a sense of the place pretty easily as a reader. It's not like you're talking about New York or Melbourne or Sydney or Amsterdam where it's just enormous. You know, these places are quite discreet in terms of the size. And country towns, I mean, I live near a whole lot of country towns and they're interesting places. They've got interesting characters. There's a lot of differences, negative, everything else, and these sort of places. And they're just interesting places to go and visit as well. With all my books, I do a lot of miles on in the car and on my feet, just looking at different places and actually just making sure I'm pretty true to life in terms of the environment that we're in.
Well, I think, yeah, as I said, Nowichuka and the Mama sort of area, and I thought you captured it really beautifully. I love going up there when I'm up there. It's just gorgeous.
Yeah, I think the other interesting part of this is because it's on a border, there's the situation of the two police forces having to work together across the river, and that really adds a little bit of complication to the whole thing.
Yeah, yes, it does. So for me, the standout of both your books has to be your character of Zoe. She's quite unique in crime for many reasons, but the thing that stuck out to me was she's a female protagonist and she's in sort of a leadership position within the Victoria Police, and it's not overly common in crime novels to have with a female protagonist. A crime still tends to lead towards the male protagonist. So what was it that appealed to you to write this story from a female perspective?
There's probably a couple of parts to the answer there. One is that the idea of the book came to me, first book, The Long Game, came to me one day in a cafe, and I scribbled the basic plot down on a napkin, and it just came to me, and Harry the dog was there, Zoe was there, and that was just the way she came out in my mind. But the other part of it is, I suppose, that writing a female protagonist allowed me a bit of freedom in terms of not having to worry that people thought I was writing about myself.
Ah, okay.
It actually gives me a degree of separation, I suppose. And I think the reason that people really connect with Zoe is that I don't write male or female characters. I wrote a detective story about a detective. And I think because there's no sort of sexist tropes about, I mean, in there that she's just a hard-nosed, tough leader in the homicide squad. And I think that people really responded well to that without me adding on sort of a lot of unnecessary sort of
drama.
I mean, there is sexism within the first book, a fair bit of sexism against her in the way, and she rails up against that. She's a very strong character. She's tough, she's brave, she's smart. Her bravery is something that really can be a bit of a double-edged sword in terms of she can be a little bit, some might say, you know, she rushes into situations where others might stand back a bit. But she's a really nuanced, interesting human detective, and that's the way I wrote her.
Yeah, you hit the sweet spot with her character in that she is, as you say, she's tough, but she's still vulnerable. So you sort of have that balance. And you show it in both books that she's tough and she can do her job and she can do her job quite well, but she does have this PTSD that she does require help with. So it was a nice balance to read a character like that. And, of course, I have to ask about Harry because I think he's my favourite part of the book. He's a dog. And you think about police officers, they really do have one of the hardest jobs in society. If the physical and emotional strain of being a police officer is just extreme. And traditionally, when in crime, protagonists tended to deal with this trauma by turning to the bottle or bad relationships. But Zoe deals with it in a more healthy way, which is fantastic, and she does it through the assistance of her service dog, Harry. So what inspired Harry?
Harry's a mixture between two our old dogs, Jackson and Daisy, who are both golden retrievers. And they were a mixture of their personalities together to create sort of Harry. I mean, Jackson was a very brave dog, a very loyal dog and a very emotionally available dog. And Daisy was a sort of a tough nut. So between the two of them, they created sort of Harry's personality. So I'm obviously very familiar. We've got two more rescue golden retrievers here now. Now the other two have gone to God. So I understand golden retrievers very well in terms of their personality and their quirks.
Mm. And so was that something that you researched? Like, it's not something I've heard of, but is it something in the world that using service dog in police force, is this something that you've come across in your research? Or?
No, it's all imagination. I did read an article a number of years ago with a former policeman who had PTSD, and he was looking to get a service dog to go back to work because he was quite badly affected and needed a dog really with him, and they wouldn't let him. And I thought, well, what about if that was possible? So, and in the first book, I talk about the fact that Zoe's such a vital member of the homicide squad and so talented that her boss really went to bat with her, bat for her with the commissioner to make sure she could actually have the dog. But they weren't pro previously, but she makes it work and she's pretty straight up with people about why she's got the dog, really dampened down their questioning about if this detective is damaged, why is she at work? She really heads it off face.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see because I found it a fascinating concept. I was like, I wonder if this does happen anywhere else in the world. So it'd be interesting to see maybe 20 years down the road, maybe we'll see it.
I'm sure.
Because it could be amazing.
I mean, there's a lot of experience that would walk out the door if people aren't able to have these sort of situations accommodated.
So. Yeah, or they turn to unhealthy options like exactly. The bottle or bad relationships.
Yeah, and I didn't want to write another drunken or drugged up cop situation because that's a pretty heavy trope really out there.
Well, it is. It certainly makes your story and your character stand out. I know you said you'd had feedback about Zoe from readers, but had there been any feedback about Harry?
Oh, yeah. No, people love Harry. The one thing, I mean, people worry about Harry because he's in a crime story that something's going to happen
yes.
to Harry. But I remember when I was talking to my publishing team at Text one day and I said, I was talking about the second book and saying I was thinking about potentially something happening to one of the characters. And they went, not the dog!
Not the dog!
And all of them started screaming, not the
not
dog.
Not Harry!
No. So Harry's fine. Harry will remain fine. I'm writing the third book in the series right now and I'm hoping to write five or six at least. So Harry's fine. Everyone else is
shielded.
Who knows what's going to happen?
We've got that on the record.
You can put it on the record.
We've got it on the record. Excellent.
What a happy life.
Yeah, and as a reader, I'm always quite fascinated by how a story comes together because obviously I experience a book the way I read it, but I'm always fascinated by how it comes together from behind the scenes. So are you a pantser who writes by the seats of your pants and lets the story take you wherever it takes you, or are you someone who plans and plots your story line out?
I plot it to death. I go through every iteration. Once I've got the original sort of kernel of an idea, I then build that out a bit like a spider web. I've got a whiteboard and I just build it all out. And then I'll work on the plot for 6 to 8 weeks before I start even writing, just to really stress test it from every which way, make sure it's believable, make sure it flows, make sure there's enough going on. And then I'll really then get deep into the weeds and start chapter one. But I also do that with all the characters. Every character in the book I do a full sort of personality and attributes chart on. And most of the things that I write in these things don't actually make the page, but they do influence the way I think about the character. They're really well worked out previously. I don't actually know how the people who write just sit down and start writing. I'm not actually sure how they do it, but not my sort of skill set.
No, and that's it. How you write and plot a story, I'm like, I couldn't do that either. So I wish I could. It'd be a great career to have. And so when you're doing that first draft, do you know how it's going to end? Or is that something that you work through and come to?
I do work through it. Generally speaking, before I start writing it, I know the whole story start to end. That said, probably 20% of it changes as I go along because I think of different things or I might see a hole in the plot that I need to fill. Sometimes new characters come in, other times major events happen. There's a major event in Wildcard which I didn't know about when I started and that came and that's fine. I can sort of deal with those sort of changes pretty easily and ramp up the tension. The book sort of starts off a bit like a 5,000 meter running race. It starts off decent clips. There's a bit of a fast jog going around and it builds and builds. And by the final sort of lap, it's running. It's absolutely going flat out. And that's the way I've written the first, or actually my three books have been written like that. Because, you know, that first bit where you're actually trying to introduce everything and you can't be running there because you need to be allowing people to get into the flow. But it really, really builds. So a lot of people, surprisingly, because I can't do it, but a lot of people I pick up the book and start it and they just go straight through and finish it in one day or in 4 or 5 hours or something. And it's just, that's a really, really good testament to.
That's it. And, you know, it is Wildcard and is a police procedural. So do you find, because part of the police procedural to a reader, the appeal is to try and solve the crime before the detective does. Do you find that line between giving clues and hints that they might be able to solve it themselves but not giving the ending away tricky? Or
yeah, it can
you just
be tricky.
Don't focus on it?
And I do focus on it because especially towards the end, it becomes really important to not give the game away. I mean, the kind of books that I write, I try and write them as very realistic books. What I mean by that is I don't write a book whereby at some stage every character is there's good characters, there's bad characters, and there's a whole lot of grey in between. And not everyone's going to be a suspect, like an Agatha Christie situation in a locked room. You know, that I try and be realistic about it. And by doing that, I suppose the list of potential instigators of crime is limited. So you've got to be more careful, I suppose, with that, because I don't want to make, you know, 1,000 unrealistic twists that people start rolling their eyes about. I want to make it realistic as possible. But that makes it a little bit harder, I suppose, from the point of view of keeping the final twist secret.
Yeah, so I'm very bad at being a detective, so I was like blown away by the twists in this book, and we won't say any more on that.
No.
So you've already said that there is a book 3 and there may be a 4, 5, 6, which is exciting.
Yes.
Is there anything you can tell us about book 3?
Yeah, book 3 set up on Mount Macedon. Yep. There's a murder of 2 people, a man and his lawyer, and it involves basically a few very ultra-rich sort of people. The person who's been murdered has been accused of a major, almost $100 million fraud, and he'd been acquitted in court. And 6 months later, he's found dead with his lawyer up at Mount Macedon, and it goes from there. So it's, the whole thing's made to look like a murder-suicide, but it's not. That's about as much as I can say on that one.
Don't want to give too much away. And obviously the ending of Wildcard obviously will create some new things to deal with in the next book, so I'm sure it'll be a thrilling read like the first two.
Yes.
Now, we are a bunch of readers here at Book Matters, so I'd be remiss not to ask for a book recommendation from you.
I'd probably, the one I've just started recently is a Gary Disher book called Day's End, which is very good so far. I'm really enjoying that. I mean, I'm surrounded by a number of 100 books around me as I speak to you, and there's lots of different sort of books, but that one's really quite a good one to capture me right now.
Yeah, I think that is on our top titles list, so that's one of the popular ones here at the library, so I will have to give that one a read as well. And should our readers want to connect with you online, what is the best platform for them to do that?
Okay, I've got a website which is simonrowell.net, or they can find me on Simon Rowell Author, so just type that in, or also on Instagram is the same sort of thing, just Simon Rowell Author, and they'll find me there too.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for the chat today, Simon. If you're a fan of thrilling, atmospheric crime reads, then Simon's Zoe Mayer series is one not to be missed. It's a gripping read with relatable characters you will come to adore. From the very first page to the very last, you'll find this one hard to put down. The Long Game and Wildcard are both available for loan from any Casey Library in book and audiobook format. Additionally, both titles are available as ebooks from our Borrowbox library and e-audiobooks from our Libby library. Thank you again, Simon. I'm so looking forward to the next instalment of Zoe Mayer.
Thanks, Courtney.
Thank you.
Now let's hear what our library staff have been reading.
I'm Tracy from Bunjil Place Library, and I've just read Life in Lashes, The Story of a Drag Superstar by Kit Amin. Winner of RuPaul's Drag Race Down Under, Kitta tells her story of how she became a fierce and confident drag queen from her humble beginnings as Nick Nash from a small Auckland suburb. Life in Lashes is an interesting read, and if you're a fan of drag or RuPaul's Drag Race, you may find this a fascinating story of how one person came to find themselves by living it their own way. Life in Lashes is available now through Borrowbox as an ebook. Borrowbox is a free app. Just download and log in with your library membership.
Hi everyone, this is Faye from Casey Gardenia Libraries, and I recently read 9 Days by Tony Jordan. 9 Days is the debut novel by Australian author Tony Jordan. It was published back in 2012 and is a very enjoyable and interesting read. The novel is set in Melbourne's inner city suburbs. Each of the 9 chapters is narrated by a different member of the Westaway family between the time of 1939 to present day. The story initially introduces us to Kip Westaway as a 13-year-old Melbourne boy in 1939. We become familiar with the rest of Kip's immediate family in this era and eventually can follow the family members' stories over 8 additional days from different perspectives during the coming decades. This novel displays families at their best and worst. It also shows us that people are not always as they first appear and how they often present themselves in a manner depicted by their families and environments. The novel novel is touched by the effects of World War II, gender role expectations, interfamily relationships and personal growth. I got a lot more out of this book than I bargained for and recommend this as a great read. Regular copies of this novel are available from our branches and as an ebook and an e-audiobook via BorrowBox. I hope you enjoy it too.
Hi, this is Michelle from Regional Support, and this month I'm looking at Somebody Knows Something, On the Trail of the Tynong North and Frankston Serial Killer. This is a true crime account of the unsolved murders of six women and girls in the 1970s and 80s. It piqued my interest as some of the women came from my local area and some of the bodies were found in Tynong North. In Somebody Knows Something, the author Brian Williams, who is also an educator, public presenter and lawyer, revisits each murder and discovery individually and then explores the suspects and the police case to the point that the book was published in 2020. The case remains unsolved, but it's complicated due to the varying locations and ages of the victims, with the only common denominator seeming to be public transport. The offer of a reward has not stirred up any new information so far as we know, but the case is ongoing. Being so close to home, as it were, it was both horrifying and captivating to relive areas I know so well and to realise that people I know may have known some of these women. Brian Williams has written several other true crime books, which you may be interested in looking into as well. Somebody Knows Something is only available in print, so place your hold for pickup at your local library when it becomes available.
Hello, this is Raylene from Casey Cardinia Libraries. I thought it was about time I read a Nora Roberts novel, so I've started the journey with a book called The Awakening, which is the first book in the Dragonheart Legacy series. In this novel, Bryn is a school teacher and she lives her life according to the expectations of other people, especially her mother. One day she decides enough. She quits her job and heads off to Ireland with her bestie Marco on a journey to discover the real her and the story of her dad, who was a musician in Ireland. Bryn and Marco have heaps of adventures like flying first class, driving in a foreign country, exploring ruins, writing a travel blog, and the ultimate adventure of falling into a portal during a walk in the woods. This is when the reader is whisked away into parallel worlds and lands of mermaids, dragons, and the story takes on a twisty kind of sci-fi turn into fantasy, and the real fun begins. The Awakening is a jaunty read with descriptions of gorgeous Irish scenery, cozy cottages, a little bit of magic, and great characters, which really make this read feel like a warm, fuzzy hug. The Awakenings is available in hard copy from Casey Cardinia Libraries.
Hello, this is Tim, and I've been reading thrilling story The Night Swim by Megan Golden. Now, if you like podcasts, and particularly true crime podcasts, this will really suck you in. Megan's written this story as an investigative journalist who works for a podcast, going to a sort of backwater American town to follow the trial of a rising star swimmer who's been accused of rape. She goes to investigate the trial and to sort of interview all of the witnesses and all of the people involved in the case. But as she rolls into town, she gets this note from another local about a cold case that happened many years ago that they say is related to them, that their sister drowned and that it wasn't a drowning, that they were murdered. It is up to our protagonist to chase down this case and try and reveal the truth. At the same time, doing this podcast about a similar investigation that's happening today. Each chapter kind of alternates between Rachel, our journalist, investigating things, but also the podcast itself. So every couple of chapters will be one of these episodes of the True Crime Podcast, and then you'll get a chapter where it's the notes and the thoughts of the sister of this past cold case murder victim. Everyone is a suspect. There's people that have been in the town for many years that know what happened. There's people that claim they might have witnessed something. And then, of course, there is this sister, this mysterious person who never really shows her face, only shares her thoughts through these letters that sort of end up in Rachel's hands in very strange ways, including sliding under her hotel room door, on her windshield of her car, and pinned to the dock at the beach with a knife. So there's lots of suspense. There's a lot going on, but also the way that it jumps between the podcast and the current event is a really good juxtaposition. There's a lot going on that's relatable to both cases, but having those podcast interludes is very good. You may have caught on, but I love audiobooks, and this is a really great audiobook. Why? Because every second chapter is the podcast. So you're getting this mix of what sounds like a true crime podcast, which is actually narrative, and get these chapters where you're following the narrative as you would. It's quite confronting. The content is quite relatable to true cases that have happened around the world about women being considered guilty or perhaps lying about events that have happened to them, about people with a lot of celebrity clout being able to get away with things like Harvey Weinstein. And there's very similar true cases to the one that's explored in the book that have happened in America as well. So be prepared for that. But also, if you are into true crime, if you love those podcasts, this is definitely the book for you. It is Megan Golden's The Night Swim. You can get it as a paperback from the library collection, Casey Cardinia, or you can track it down on Borrowbox as an audiobook.
If you enjoy listening to Book Matters, we would love you to give us a rating at your favourite podcast provider. That way, other book lovers will be able to find us too.
For more details on the books mentioned in this podcast, as well as information from the library, head to www.cclc.vic.gov.au or visit our new Facebook group, In a Nook with a Book, where you can let us know what you've been reading. Until next time, this has been Janine, and you've been listening to Book Matters, a CCLC podcast for people who like to read, made by people who love reading. Goodbye.